An Ash Wednesday Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 5, 2003, entitled, Meeting Our Mortality. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 3, verses 1 through 3, and 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 through 28. Copyright Grand Valley State University. Please note that the original recording spanned two sides of a cassette tape, so there was some missing material. I will bridge the gap.
Dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return. That's the theme of this evening. And as I have mentioned often here, this, along with the All Saints Day service, has become one of my favorite services. There's something about it that appeals to me. I hope it's not a sense of morbidity, but rather the honesty of the evening, the vulnerability of it, the solemnity of it. It's a service in which we are invited to meet our mortality. And I think perhaps meeting our mortality, the thing that I want to say this evening, can be told best in stories. So I have five stories. The first two stories come out of a recently published book called entitled The Question of God. A Harvard professor of psychiatry who's been lecturing at Harvard University for the past 33 years and also now lectures at the medical school developed a course on the comparison, the debate about the question of God, questions of love and sex and the meaning of life, in a dialogue between Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. Dr. Armand Nicolai published this book as a consequence or as a rendering of that seminar that he has offered now for so many years. He only accepts 20 participants in the seminar, and there are usually 200 applicants. The popularity of it, obvious. And in this seminar, he lets C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud talk to each other and with each other about these ultimate questions. The last chapter is entitled Death. And in that chapter, he talks about Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis as they faced death. Freud, you know, was the great materialist. This is all there is, and there's nothing more. And he was not only an atheist, but he was a militant atheist, really believing that he had to rid society of those wishful thinking dreams with which they slumbered through life. But he himself lived a rather unhappy life. He, of course, was so aware and brought to the awareness, general awareness, the fact that our consciousness is but the tip of an iceberg, and the unconscious moves us in ways we hardly have begun to understand. He said, our reason is like the plaything of our emotions and our impulses. Freud was horrified of death. He thought he was going to die at age 41. And then when he didn't, he thought it would be probably sometime around age 54. And then it was going to be 61. And some of these numbers he arrived at through a kind of numerology where you see, it's like a gambler playing the lottery where you see a number flash somewhere and say that must be it for the day. It's rather surprising that this rationalist in his approach to the human being should have been so superstitious about his own death. He was horrified of it. And during his life, he lost his most beloved daughter, Sophia, at age around 40, at which time she had a 4.5-year-old who came to live with the Freuds, a child who died at age 6. And he had absolutely no consolation and no comfort. He finally fled the continent in the late 30s as Hitler was coming to power. He fled to London. He lived there for a relatively short time. He died in that exile at age 83. And he died through euthanasia, having made a pact with his doctor that when he got to a terminal point, the doctor would give him an injection, which he did. C.S. Lewis, of course, English, also at Oxford, Cambridge, London, there's a slight possibility that they may have met, even though Lewis was some 50 years younger than Freud. Freud may have been aware of Lewis's work, but Lewis was certainly aware of Freud's work and made some references to Freud's work. C.S. Lewis, as you probably know, began as an atheist. He was happy about the fact. He was happy about the fact that atheism gave him an end point. He said of the Christian faith, the problem with it is there's no exit sign anywhere. But in his adult life, he was converted to Christianity. He's written a lovely book with a lovely title, Surprised by Joy. And he talks about being dragged, kicking and screaming into the kingdom. He came to a very traditional understanding of the Christian faith, and he became the great apologist for the Christian faith. He had a razor-sharp mind, and in the apologetic effort to defend the faith, he explained it, and he exposited it over against any argument against it. And he held a rather traditional view of death and life after death, and came to say, with St. Paul, certainly should we not then even desire our death? Later in his life, he became ill, and he faced his possible death with good humor and cheerfulness. He recovered, but then sometime later, he did become terminally ill. He spent his last days reading some of the great classics that he had loved throughout his life. And then the last book he read was a great French novel, and he had a friend in to converse about it. And the friend said when he left, he had the sense that it would be the last time they would ever be together. And he said, certainly no one was better prepared for death than C.S. Lewis. And his brother Warren says that as his death approached, there was cheerfulness, good humor, tranquility. So now, of course, on All Saints Night, the sermon now comes to its conclusion. That is a typical, predictable Christian sermon, which would say, you see, if you are a militant atheist like Freud, you are afraid of death and you experience death with horror. And if you are a believing Christian, like C.S. Lewis, you die at peace. But you've never found me to preach a predictable sermon. So I have to tell you a third story, or about a third person. And that person is a Dr. Gaybord Levy. I know really nothing about him, but somebody put this in my hand from somewhere. Dr. Levy was a distinguished scientist, and in his retirement years, he died at age 85, but in his last years, he was writing editorials. And this is an editorial he wrote for the American Laboratory, a journal that I have never seen, apparently a scientific journal. And he starts out, "This is my last editorial, and by the time it is printed, I shall be buried. This will serve to thank you and to wish you well." But what's the editorial about? Well, the editorial is about how can any scientist be sincerely religious? Now he says, "I had enough sense during my life to know enough not to write a piece like this, because I would be vilified up and down, and nothing would upset people more than to tell you how I think about religion, the fact that it is really a fairy tale, that it is a dream, that there is no substance to it." In fact, he said, how could a scientist be religious? And he says, "Nonetheless, I really want to deliver my soul of this question that's always been with me. And I do it now, and after I'm death, I trust the old saying, speak no ill of the dead." So he thinks, "I'm going to get this off my chest, and I'll be gone, and you'll have enough respect not to take me apart." Well, I only have to read a few lines to you. This is the way the editorial closes. He says, "I have made peace with this fact that there is nothing more." He says, I have made peace with this long ago and threw away the crutches. I've been free and in full control. There's no devil to blame and no supreme power to forgive. Accordingly, you must conduct your own life with decency and civility. You can easily overcome what Roger Cruton calls transcendental loneliness and be glad of it. You must accept that there is no particular meaning or purpose to existence. All life will cease on earth anyway when the sun's fuel runs out, and humankind will have vanished long before that. Birth and death are both traumatic. There is a symmetry here, from dust to dust, as the good book says. I am perfectly satisfied that I am being recycled, that only a few friends and family may remember me fondly, and that even this will vanish in a few short years. Nothing will remain. This is how nature works. But just because life is so short and without transcendent meaning, that does not mean that we should not use it wisely and enjoy it. Should all this sound like an atheist's manifesto? In a way it is. I lived by it happily. I leave with my eyes open and without fear and few regrets. I have my little vanities like everybody else. And for the short time that I am remembered, I hope that it will be as John Adams hoped, as an honest man in all and to the death. And so I wish all my friends peace and good luck. Farewell." The introduction to the editorial said that his wife reported that he put down his pen, and within a few moments he died. Now you see, if I had stopped with Freud and Lewis, the atheist for whom death was a horror and the believer for whom death was received peacefully, and it set them up against each other, I wouldn't have been honest with you. Because there are people like Gabor Levy as well, who live without any hope of anything beyond this life, but meet it with the same kind of tranquility that C.S. Lewis met it with his Christian hope. So often in the church, we set up straw men and then destroy them, rather than being honest with the fact that there's a whole variety of people out there, and a whole variety of people meet death in different ways. So, Freud, Lewis, Levy. Let me tell you about a fourth person, Dr. Laurel Clark. She was one of the astronauts on the Columbia tragedy. I happened to catch an interview with her husband sometime a week or so ago. It was a most inspiring interview, in which he told about the fact that Laurel Clark and her elementary age son had been featured in a Scholastic Reader. Their pictures were on the cover, and that reader was mailed out the day before the tragedy. And Dr. Clark wrote to Scholastic, asking them not to recall that issue. And then, in the interview, he went on to speak about the death of his wife and the mother of his son. They were Unitarian. And I had noted earlier that the various astronauts had experienced the various rituals of death of their respective faiths. There was the megachurch, somewhat fundamental perhaps, conservative and evangelical Christian, in which of course all of the trappings of the Christian faith were there. But Laurel Clark was Unitarian. And there wasn't a lot of talk about what comes after, and certainly none of this, oh, she's in a better place, the kind of denial that really rankles me, frankly. What was spoken of was the celebration of her life. And Dr. Clark, about his wife now, had just viewed the 14 minutes, that miraculous videotape that was recovered, the last 14 minutes of those astronauts in their approach to reentry. And he said, and I really think he said this, although it was a poor choice of words, they were having a blast. And he said, their lives, her life, was full of the wonder of space. And then he went on to say, and we must continue to explore, realizing that there are perils. And I was moved by that. That positive way of acknowledging death with the emphasis on the celebration of a life that died being fulfilled. And my fifth story is even more personal.
Some of you have heard me share the fact that Norm and Barb Timmer came to Christ Community when we took our stand affirming homosexuality as a natural manifestation of God's creation, a given by birth, not by choice. They drove up from Holland every Sunday as a show of solidarity with us.
Deliberately, because that which was emanating forth from this community is what they affirmed. And they were always encouraging and always so positive. And when I got back from Florida, there was an email from their son from Washington, D.C., saying that his father was failing. And so 2 weeks ago today, I called. They live in Holland. And Barbara said, oh, he's in the inn in Freedom Village, and I'm on my way to visit him now. And I said, could I come and see him? And she said, he would love that. And so I went. And he had not been talking much for a couple of weeks. He couldn't get his breath. His mouth was dry. He is the thinnest man I've ever seen. But when I came into the room, it's as though he came alive. And he said, Dick, I want you to do my service. And I didn't know anything about this. But then the story came out. He said, we were there last November at the All Saints Day service. And we got in the car after that service and looked at each other and said, that's what we want at our funeral. And then he began to tell about his story. How as an 11 or 12-year-old in catechism, he would ask questions, and his father spoke to him about that because the minister had spoken to him about the fact that it was disturbing the class. And then he told about how what we are here had meant so much to them. And he looked at me and he said, you've changed my life. And I said, oh, Norm, I didn't change your life. I brought to expression what you deeply believe and what you had always believed, but which you had not had permission to trust. Well, we had just one of those beautiful encounters and prayer. I had given him that wonderful verse from Deuteronomy, the eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are everlasting arms. And I left, and Barbara went out with me, and tears streaming down her cheek. And that evening when we got home, there was a message on the answering machine. It was Barbara Timmer. And her voice tailed off at the end, but I thought she had thanked me for coming, and I thought she said, Norm is good. I thought, well, I'll call in the morning. But before I could call, she called. And we're talking, and I said, wait a minute, Barbara. I think you told me last night Norm was good. She said, Dick, I said, Norm is gone. He said, the head nurse came in after you left and saw it immediately. You gave him permission to die. He was able to let go. Well, now the service, the funeral. I'm supposed to preach at Hope Reformed Church in Holland what I preached here on All Saints Day at Norman's request. Which, of course, one can't really do. But I did bear witness to what Norm wanted to have witnessed to. And it was that death need not be the last enemy. I'm sure you remember last November the title, Death, the Last Enemy? And my point was that in the Christian church, in the Christian story, in the Christian scheme of things, we have put so much baggage on death. I read that little piece from Genesis 3, in the day you eat thereof, you shall surely die, as though death is not a part of creation's intention, as though death is not something natural, but something unnatural, as though death is a penalty connected with sin, that it involves guilt and possible condemnation. Is it any wonder that we have been afraid to die? With all of that that has been put on what is, as a matter of fact, as natural as breathing. To be born, to be and to become, and to die. And in the meantime, to live. And to celebrate life I argue with St. Paul. Death is not the last enemy. And it is not to be shrouded over with guilt and fear of punishment. Life is a gift. Life is to be lived fully, savored deeply. And then death can be met with tranquility. I could bear witness to Norman. He wanted that sermon which said, death is the natural end of life, and it can be received with peace. And ironically, beautifully, it was precisely the way he experienced it. It seems to me that Jesus died that way. John tells us he tended to his mother. He gave expression to his physical need, I thirst. And he said, it is complete. Would to God that all of us would so meet our mortality that we might in the meantime live fully. In the end, die peacefully.